Revived Thoughts is a production of Revive Studios.
This is Troy and Joel, and you are listening to Revive Thoughts.
The craving for artificial stimulation burns like raging thirst and ravenous hunger. For the false excitement has become as necessary to strength and happiness as food once was.
Every episode, we bring you a different voice from history in a sermon that they delivered. Now we're going back to Connecticut in the year 1826 to listen to a sermon named Lyman Beecher.
No, the sermon's not named Lyman Beecher. It's by Lyman Beecher.
A sermon by Lyman Beecher. Troy, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. I hope you don't edit that out. That made me laugh. That was solid.
Yeah, it's part of the intro now.
Oh, by the way, I always try to gather comments and things from the show, and I love this first comment that I saved. It cracks me up every time I see it. Somebody listened to an episode of ours a few weeks ago, left a comment on YouTube, and they said, quote, hereafter, quote, how to cook a bear, ... great pod. And I want to know how the YouTube algorithm was like, hey, you like listening to, you like learning how to cook a bear? Check out Revive Thoughts. Like,
seen that before? Is that a thing?
No, I've never heard anybody say, I came and found your show after watching How to Cook a Bear. So do we have a flood of listeners coming in that way? Like, they're watching good bear videos and then boom, they're listening to an old sermon from like 300 years ago. I mean, I don't think that's super common, but maybe it is. Maybe you let us know if you come into our show via the How to Cook a Bear YouTube algorithm network. Please let us know. I'd love to hear from you.
I will take the bear cooking people I mean, the algorithm is pretty good, you know, and it sounds like we do have listeners from it.
A big Venn diagram in the middle there between bear cookers and Revive Thoughts listeners. I'm sure it's huge. I mean, it makes sense too. I'm sure it takes a while to cook a grizzly. That's like, what, 2,000 pounds of meat? That can't be the right number. But anyway, it's a lot of meat, right? Well, they may be polar bear cookers. We don't know what they're cooking. So you probably got a lot of time on your hands. And so you got to listen to something between the smoking and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So
put some Revive Thoughts on.
I appreciate that. I really want to hear more from those listeners and how they got there. But I just think it's funny. I think it's also funny. Just he's like, I went from that to this great podcast. Like, this is definitely his first interaction with us, and he enjoyed the show. I'm so glad you're listening. All right, another one we got here from Katie. She says, thank you. I've been thinking about this a lot this past year. This is our episode, our conversation you and I did, Joel, on heaven. Yeah. She says, I've been thinking about this a lot this past year after I mentioned being happy about getting a perfected body in heaven without pain. And everyone got really quiet. Like, you can only be happy about seeing Jesus and not all the other great heavenly things that come with it. I agree we should be reminding each other of our hope of heaven often because it's really the best encouragement. I'm glad you experienced that. No, I'm not glad you experienced that. I'm glad you shared that experience with us because that was how I felt as well. I was like, I remember something like that too, where I'm like, I can't wait for heaven. It's going to be great to... Can you imagine the food up there? And people are like, the only thing that matters is that you'll be with Jesus. I'm like, well, yeah, obviously that's important. It's the most important thing. But also, like, Jesus wouldn't have mentioned these other things if we weren't supposed to be excited about them, guys. Like, we're supposed to have joy about the whole thing, the whole experience. So I'm not going to go back into that. That was on our episode. But I'm glad that connected with one other person. I'm glad that I think maybe even some others. Kentucky 00 Buck says...
Double hot. He corrected you on this once before. It's double hot, Buck.
Once upon a time, we read this guy's comment, and I said, thank you, Caillou Buck. And he apparently was like, hey, idiot, that's not what my username says. I'm like, well, all right, then. I even told myself, don't mess this up. You've done this before. But he sent us his Revive Thoughts Spotify Wrapped, and he says, tweeps, check out my favorite podcast, Revive Thoughts. It's the GOAT, which means greatest of all time, not GOAT as in it's going to, you know, be split up from the sheep and be in trouble. And he has 4,586 minutes of listening. That's amazing. I can't even...
Read that wrong. It's 4,850, nearly 5,000.
Holy smokes, even more than I had. It was even higher.
Nearly 5,000 minutes, which does place him in the 0.5% of top fans.
I don't know if it goes higher than that. I mean, is there a 0.1%? It's almost scary to think that it could go higher than that. I think that's about got to be as high as you can get, right? That's like, impressive. But that's amazing. And
definitely deserves a shout out.
I don't know what that is in hours and days, but you definitely deserve a shout out. And concernedly, you might listen to us more than our own spouses do. I don't know how many minutes a day my wife listens to me. So it's got to be probably up there, right? Like, I'm sure it's something. So congratulations. And I'm really sorry I messed up your username again, like 4 years later. So that was my bad. But keep it up. But again, we can always do better. All right, let's get 5,000 for 2026. We can keep going. There's no reason to quit while we're ahead, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay, Lyman Beecher. You want to talk about Lyman Beecher?
I do want to talk about Lyman Beecher. That's what we're here to do. I came to the right place. Was it the Lyman Beecher episode name that came away?
We are here. We are here. Born in the year 1775 in New Haven, Connecticut. When Lyman was young, his mother died, and he was raised by his aunt and his uncle. His father, growing up, was a blacksmith, and so it was expected that he would be raised in his father's ways and also be a blacksmith as well, but he really did not have a real aptitude for blacksmithing or farming. He was made for studies. He was a smart child, which I think... would be weird to be in a society. You think 1700s in America, that's still like pretty early on fundamental days. Like, people had jobs to do to survive, you know? Like, what do you do with the kid that isn't any good at farming, isn't any good at blacksmithing, isn't any good at like doing the things that like our society kind of needs, hunting, you know? You're just a smart kid. You're an intellectual.
I'm gonna say something that is super not needed, and this is not the track we need to go on. But this is actually why I don't like How to Train Your Dragon. The kid in that movie—if you've ever seen that movie, that film for children's
cinema—but
like the kids, for starters, the kid's name is Hiccup, which I don't know how that got through the writing room. But he can't do anything. He's worthless. He's in Viking village. Mm-hmm. He can't kill dragons. He has no skills. I don't know if you know much about the Vikings, but they're kind of tough. They have terrible winners. Like, they need to have skills. This kid has none. And he won't kill dragons. The one thing that, like, regularly destroys this village and, like, has seemingly killed everyone that they love and know. And I always am like, you could have had anybody. It's like the first kids movie with dragons. Like, we've never done it before. And you went with loser kid that nobody, like, has no discernible skills whatsoever and would die in any. And I know you're listening to me and going, dear gosh, stop talking about How to Train a Dragon. You're the worst. I do this to movies. I do apologize. But I'm just, for me, it drove me crazy. I couldn't get it. I couldn't buy it.
You understand that's the point of the movie, though.
Yeah, and he's found his own solution because he found the cat. But if he found literally any other dragon, it would have eaten him before he figured out they were nice. And that's just a fact. Okay, it was just that he happened to find the one dragon for the movie. Look at that story plot armor protecting. Okay, I'm done. But the point is, that's what Lyman Beecher was Hiccup, okay?
Yeah. And I think the story arc of him becoming a preacher is a better arc. Finding Hiccup.
If you haven't seen How to Train Your Dragon, then that entire monologue was worthless to you. And I do apologize. Great soundtrack, though. If you're ever on YouTube run into the How to Train Your Dragon soundtrack, that part's pretty good.
Yeah. So I suppose to answer our question, what do you do when you're a kid that doesn't have any useful skills for the culture that you're in? In this era, in America, and this is interesting because this would be different in different parts of the world, but... this is like still, we're coming out of Puritan, colonized, people in America. So you become a minister. Like that is the one non-physical thing that the people are all about and all for. Is like, okay, you can become a leader of spiritual things. And so he went off to Yale to study when he was 18 years old. Now Yale... we think of Yale, it's got quite the reputation these days, but I actually looked it up. Guess how many students Yale had in late 1700s?
All right, so how many students did Yale have in the late 1700s? Jonathan Edwards went when he was like 13 in the early 1700s. 1,000?
Less than 100.
Less than 100, so I was less way than, off the mark.
Less than 100, and there was one that speculated possibly less than 50. So this,
wow, that
this
is really was, small.
Again, just to kind of give you an understanding of, well, first of all, people are busy hunting and farming. And so there's not a lot of people in Beecher's category here, but it's a small, that like that is the theology school. Like if you're gonna, if you're a Puritan coming out of the Puritan era and you're want to be a minister, you're gonna go to Yale with, you know, 70 other people and learn how to be, get your ordination, right?
Joel, you seem to be qualifying a lot. Like that's not where people go to get their Puritan education now. Has Yale changed?
Oh boy. Yes, it has.
Oh no. Oh gosh.
It's so funny. I was actually just kind of like poking around the Wikipedia page of Yale, and I'm like, this school has a pretty cool past. It's I don't know. It's pretty sad to see kind of just the arc of. I'm curious if you do, like if you just give a school enough time and money, will they secularize over time? Because that seems to be kind of the path.
I can't think of a lot of, exemptions to that rule, right? Like we mentioned many times Princeton people, and it's the same place pretty much. I don't know about Cambridge and Oxford, but I don't get the impression they're nearly as Christian as they were 150 mm-hmm. years ago. Although we did, 300 years ago, we had that episode where the guy wrote a joke about how they kicked people out for praying. So maybe it was a struggle even then. I think that was Cambridge. And then, even some of these seminaries, we've covered on our show, I don't know that there is concern, like even some of the Southern Baptist ones, I don't know that the people who founded them would be happy. Maybe they would be, but that one I think would take more study for me to be able to be confirmed on one way or the other. So I don't. Where's the exception to that rule? Where's the school that no matter how much time and money it's given, it just stays where it was when it was founded without trying to keep up with it?
Yeah, revivethoughts@gmail.com. Let us know.
You've missed the very obvious one. This random academy somewhere. It does feel like it's a problem, and it feels like. What happens is people create new schools to kind of match, and then eventually, 100 years later, people go, remember when that school used to be something? It just seems to kind of be the repeating cycle.
Mm-hmm. He enjoyed his time at Yale, and it seems like the president of the university kind of took him under his wing and took a special interest in him. His first ordination sent him to Long Island, New York, and there he met and married his wife, Roxanne. His first salary was $300 a year. I'm not actually sure what that converts to. Troy, look it up real quick
I saw that $400 converted to $8,000 in 2024.
Okay.
Which seems low.
So not a lot.
Not a lot. That it gets you, it doesn't get you nothing, but it doesn't get you a lot.
But this job came with all of the firewood you needed, free firewood. Boom. So he breaks even. Probably.
Of course, back then, like with the way America was, could you just cut down any trees you wanted and that would also be your firewood?
That's a lot of work.
But but we already went over how Lyman Beecher couldn't work, so maybe he needed that extra firewood.
If he could be cutting down trees, he would have been cutting down trees.
Like in his case, the exception, like we'll get your firewood for you, Beecher. We can see you're not up for it.
Beecher, please. We'll take care of the firewood. His wife opened up a private school to teach students. That was in a way that they also kind of supplemented their income. So it wasn't just him on his pastor salary. His wife also helped run a little school, and that's how they made ends meet.
Joel, as a very into-the-know pop culture kind of person that you are, you remember like 10 years ago when everyone loved that musical Hamilton, right?
Yeah, Alexander Hamilton.
Oh yeah, was that part of it? I don't
think so.
Remember.
I've any never of actually songs. Watched it. That's osmosis.
Oh, I was gonna ask you, have you seen it? Because I
haven't.
I have watched the King George clips on YouTube. I think his little song was catchy, where he's all like, "You'll be back." But I don't remember anything else about it. So, but apparently, if you had watched the musical, then the sex part would be refreshing information to you, because you would know that Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr, one of those being the vice president at the time. Got into a little bit of a fight called a duel, where in 1804 they tried to shoot one another out of frustration, and one of them died. Aaron Burr shot Alexander Hamilton in the stomach. Alexander Hamilton missed and hit a nearby branch, so he did not shoot Aaron Burr. And the next day, Alexander succumbed to his wound, so he died. And Aaron Burr's reputation was ruined because he shot Alexander Hamilton and killed him. And he's considered a founding father hero here. And this was considered, all in all, a general bad idea. Now, I mean, we live 200 years in the future, and dueling has gone down. But I don't know.
Not as popular as it was.
Not as popular, but maybe it needs to make a comeback. I just don't know if we've done the proper... I mean, America sure isn't what it was founded as. Is it because we got rid of duels? Like, is a gentleman's duel something we need to bring... It's just, okay, it's just wild to me that, like, famous... Not even celebrities. Like, these are famous, like, important... They are celebrities, but they're also, like, leaders are dueling each other. I can't imagine our current crop of, like, government leaders in the United States of America dueling out. I'm also surprised we haven't brought that back, if that makes sense. Like, I could see it becoming a thing. So you're wondering, what does this have to do with anything? Well, in 1806, Beecher preached a sermon titled The Remedy for Dueling. And this gained him quite a bit of fame because people were pretty upset with these duels. And this wasn't the only one that happened. It was kind of a thing back in the day. I imagine you threw down and said, I'll meet you at high noon. Or no, that's actually like the cowboy duels. Anyway, point is, they were doing too many duels and important people were dying from these things. And Beecher preached against it. And this was kind of his first famous social reform sermon. But that's going to be kind of one of the big things that he's really... The reason we know his name today is because he was big on like, hey, we need to change society and live out our Christianity through the way we're living. As his family grew, and his family will grow mighty large, he will have 13 children, his salary will need to meet up. And it's not happening. So in Long Island, he has to kind of leave, and he goes back to Connecticut, where he will minister at a church called Litchfield for the next 16 years. And this is, by the way, Litchfield, Connecticut, not super famous today. Sorry, anybody from Connecticut listening. But it was apparently a very big deal at the time. To quote Beecher while he was there, like, Litchfield is the London of the West. I don't think anybody's calling it that anymore. But at the time, there were a lot of people and a lot of pastors getting trained in Litchfield that would go on to other places. So Beecher's in an important place at an important time. And that's where the sermon you're going to listen to today is actually from.
So these sermons were very influential, particularly in growing a temperance movement that Beecher was also very adamant for. Beecher, very anti-alcohol. And this became very prevalent in his sermons and in his approach to society. Alcohol was evil to him, and society did have maybe an unhealthy relationship with alcohol during this time. It's said that the average adult consumed 7 gallons of pure alcohol every year, and it was common in workplaces to have what's called a gorg, which was a new word for me. A gorg, which is a time where people take
grog.
A grog?
Yeah.
A grog. A grog. A grog. Okay, grog is also still unfamiliar to me, though. Although,
well, to me, I hear grog, and I think of like the name of like a goblin you'd meet in Dungeons and Dragons or something. I don't think of this as like a work side time.
Yeah, it is. It is a drink break at work, and like sometimes mandated drink break. Like it was typically at 11 a.m. and 4 p.m. where people would take a drink break.
For drinking alcohol, like you weren't taking like your 15-minute mandated liquors. Starbucks or, you know, McDonald's break. You have to go drink some whiskey, probably with a group, having fun.
it's really very much the opposite of our current workplace, where you're not supposed to drink on company time. This one you were mandated to drink.
Then you were required. Like, you haven't had your morning tip. It sounds like something you would hear, and I hope this doesn't sound offensive, but it sounds like something you'd hear coming from, like, Russia or somewhere like that today. It doesn't sound like an American thing, but it was in the 1800s.
No, yeah. And this was happening in the church as well. Like, again, this was the culture then. So amongst pastors and elders, they had a reputation for getting drunk and being drunk at meetings as well. Not a great look, not a great approach. Rum and whiskey were cheaper, and this was kind of the main reason. Cheaper than milk. And so they were consumed more regularly. So cheap, in fact, that they were actually used as currency. 25 cents a gallon would be the equivalent, and you could just swap gallons in place of a quarter, I guess, back then. So dirt cheap, which I've heard like in some places, like, alcohol can be It's safer to drink than your water, you know, because you don't know what kind is distilled. And
that was another thing it said. I mean, they said it was cheaper than tea, cheaper than coffee, cheaper than milk. It was the cheapest drink you could get. Mm-hmm. And it was safer often because it was distilled. Like, you knew that it had, you know, purified and all that. But it is really like... People do not like the temperance movement. People do not like prohibition. We're not here to be, you know, let's bring the prohibition back, boys, or anything. But I can also see, like, if I was growing up in this world where people are taking drink breaks twice a day and you're going to church to, like, talk to your pastor about an important issue in your family and he's drunk from the grog time, I can kind of see why maybe people were like, we need to get a handle on this. We are falling apart. Like, that... I feel like going around and saying, you know what, maybe no alcohol for everyone for a while. I could see myself getting pulled into that because this sounds crazy.
Yeah, 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 it does. And so people that were sympathetic towards the temperance movement or were curious about it resonated well with Beecher's sermons. They were very influential, even in secular circles. Like, they were used in secular arguments about alcoholism. I guess that's a good representation of how much of an issue it was. If even the secular crowds are like, should we be doing something about how drunk everybody is all the time? These sermons were translated into several languages. This is just kind of give you a little idea of how influential they are. 50 years later, we still have accounts of them being circulated and cited and read all throughout Europe. So they made their way over to Europe in documents. They were translated, and 50 years later, people were still using them to make arguments about an anti-alcohol stance. So that's a pretty good reach for a guy in America in the late 1700s, early 1800s.
It's impressive, too, because you think of, like, oh, that idea of Americans banning alcohol or whatever, that kind of stuff. It's so backwards. Americans were so prudish. But, I mean, the Europeans were reading this as, like, this is an influential forward-thinking idea in the 1860s, 70s, and 80s. Again, we're not here to push for prohibition. And if you think the point of a temperance sermon here is purely just, let's get rid of the alcohol. We'll cover that in a minute, but that's not really what the point of this sermon, why we brought this particular one back. But he's a highly controversial era to be a pastor. Honestly, we talk about eras you don't want to be a pastor in. This guy's life made me shift positions a little bit on what, like, I've had eras, I think a good revived conversation, actually. When do you not want to be a pastor? Like, what would be a really hard time to pastor in? And this would definitely be one of those times. You have the early abolition movement kind of taking off here in the 1800s, 1820s. You have a Unitarian crisis where these Unitarian churches kind of all have been kind of growing into a movement, and they start to come out as, like, we're against the idea of eternal damnation. We think it's just kind of temporary or whatever. It's eventually going to lead to universalism. You have the temperance movement happening, all these people kind of realizing alcohol has gone too far and they're reacting to it. Expanding westward in America, so people are sending missionaries out to settle into the plains and whatnot. Yeah, the Second Great Awakening, which that alone is very controversial. Some people love it, some people really do hate it, and some people are like, I need to study it some more.
As we wrap up 2025, one thing's clear. Uncertainty isn't temporary. It's the world we live in now. Noble Gold Investments helps Americans protect what they've built with real gold and silver, holding value when everything else feels uncertain. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and take your first step toward a safe future. This holiday season, when you open up a qualified account, you'll receive 10 one-ounce commemorative silver holiday coins. Visit Noble Gold today.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
The Second Great Awakening gets a lot of flack, but men like Beecher, who were preaching during that time, they really saw, like, hey, Christians should live Christian lives, and that was a part of what they were preaching as they were going around, either calling people to commit to Christ at their, in their evangelistic outreaches, or calling people who are Christians to commit to living in a Christian way in society. One area was temperance, and a lot of people, again, they don't like that one today. It's not very popular. But another area that the Second Great Awakening really, I mean, it's a directly influenced this, is abolition. Like, if we're just like, if you're a Christian, you shouldn't be drunk all the time. Like, we got to get that together. They were saying, if you're a Christian, you should be against owning people. We've got to stop doing that. And I don't really feel like the Second Great Awakening gets the credit for this that it deserves. But without the Second Great Awakening, it does seem like the abolition movement really flourished and came out of that movie. Everything I saw was like, yeah, you're not. This is a direct link between these two. And so if we didn't have the one, I don't know if we would have the other, or at least it would have taken longer for abolition to take hold in the States. And most of us are pretty glad. I think we can say we're pretty glad that slavery was abolished. Unitarians were another big movement Beecher had to deal with. They kind of came out against him. Big fights over whether the Trinity was real and stuff like that. Beecher got into some trouble himself. He was a buttoned up guy, but he was using some of the evangelistic outreach things, like hosting a camp where they'd invite a bunch of people and preach sermons to them, things like that. And some of the older kind of members of his congregation viewed him as getting, too heretical, kind of charged him as a Unitarian. He had to go to a trial in 1835, and this is a really bad time for him to go to trial because he has a whole bunch of things going on in his life. He will be acquitted of all these charges, but it just kind of left a stain on his reputation to be accused of heresy. If you have a pastor that could be over your church who's never been accused of it, and you guy has, you're going to like the guy who's never been accused of it. Even though purely he was just seemingly attacked for just, doing new things at church that was common at the time that nobody had done in that church particularly before.
Bad timing, too, for the trial that he had to go through because his wife was on her deathbed. And so he's trying to juggle caring for his wife, trying to juggle this trial, trying to juggle the role of being the president at a seminary, which is a new position that he was stepping into, and immediately getting into trouble there. This seminary had just had one of the most troubling times that it had gone through up until that point. And the conversation around slavery was very popular right now, especially amongst Christian circles. What are we doing about slavery? And Beecher's approach, opinion on this, as well as many others at the time, was that the best thing to do would be to free our slaves and to send them back to Africa, where that seems like what they want to do. It seems like that would make them happy. So we'd send them back to Africa. And this was a very controversial approach to that. There were a lot of people that wanted to keep him here, like just had alternate plans for what they thought should happen to slaves in America. And this caused quite the debate amongst the school. And, it really ended up getting stacked against Beecher. He was in the minority here, which, I mean, good for him now. I feel like out of all the people, he has probably one of the most like transparent abolitionist motivations there. And his children actually would be some of the most prominent abolitionists in American history here. His daughter, Harriet Beecher Stowe, would actually become the author of Uncle Tom's Cabin. And his son would also be very influential in the abolitionist movement there. So they learned from their father and they took it and they rolled with it. But during this time, this intense debate amongst people at this college went on for an 18-day stretch. And for those that were in favor of Beecher and his approach to it, it was kind of like a little abolitionist revival that took place there until a group of pro-slavery people heard about it, and they came rolling into town to investigate what this ruckus was about.
Now, this got bad because it looked like a mob was forming, and professors were being threatened by these pro-slavery people from Kentucky that kind of came to these debates to kind of cause some trouble. And it has to be noted, this is not like an empty threat. Like, they weren't just a group of people panicking. There had been an anti-black riot that had happened in Cincinnati a few years before where they were like trying to attack anybody who was supporting black people. There had been one in New York just the next year after this incident here at the seminary. One of the students participating in these debates went down to Nashville to pass out like abolitionist literature and got whipped in public for it, like publicly prosecuted and whipped here. And then on top of that, when they found out, they sent the newspapers all around Lane Theological Seminary published out basically like students from Lane getting whipped for trying to, bring about abolition. What will Lane do as this riot gets looking bigger and bigger? And then another college in Ohio just a year before this looked like they were going to have a riot over the same issue of abolition. And so they shut down all speech. They said, hey, no talking about this. We can't have a riot here. So they decided to do the same thing. Stop the violence by banning all speech. Now, I looked this up. One or two places were saying, like, hey, Beecher did this. But from what I can tell, it looked like Beecher was out of town, actually, in Boston, raising support for the seminary. And so it was kind of a school board decision that was made while he wasn't there. But it was very strict. You couldn't talk about abolition, period. And you even at mealtime, like, you know, the classic, you're in college and you're hanging out and you're chatting stuff over. Not allowed to talk about abolition. You cannot talk about it. It's too controversial. Well, this led to 50 different students quitting the school as a sign of protest. They would go on to be called the Lane Rebels, and this helped spread the cause of abolition. Like, it became a big news story. People in the North loved these students. In fact, it's considered the first student protest that actually, like, made a difference, where a bunch of students do something together. And it's also the first time the abolition movement really made, like, a big splash in headlines of working together doing something like this. The students went to nearby Oberlin College, provided that the school, Oberlin, would promise to accept black students, which they did. This really upset Beecher, by the way, because he was like, we already accept black students at our school. Like, why are you leaving our school and going to a school where they were rejecting them until 5 minutes ago? Beecher was torn, as he wanted to end slavery. But he thought the radical abolitionist view would encourage slaveholders to fight harder to keep their slaves, and it could probably lead to violence. And in many ways, Beecher is correct about his predictions, because we see that history proved that those two predictions were correct, that slaveholders would fight harder for their slaves, and violence, the Civil War, was the inevitable result. I still think that the radical abolitionists were correct in the long run. I just don't think Beecher was trying to be the guy who's like, let's do this the peaceful way, but it was just an issue that wasn't going to be solved the peaceful way. All these schools' actions angered the school board, and then the next year, right after, so everyone's leaving the school, the school's kind of getting shut down. Remember, Yale has, you said, between 50 and 100 students. Well, 50 students just quit the seminary. That, and this seminary is not Yale, so that's really bad. Then the next year, his wife is dying, and he gets put on trial for heresy. So this is not a great year or so for Beecher.
No, and the sad part is his school never recovered from this. In 1837, it would have no students at all, and he would recruit more and attempt to build it back, but it seems like it never became sustaining again and puttered out. In his 70s, he retired from the seminary, and his dreams of seeing it all prosper kind of were dashed, and he kind of gave up on it. So he continued to fight and be relevant in various societal fights for years to come. But it turns out his biggest contribution, his biggest influence, would actually end up being his children. You know, and this is, again, one of those things that you can only kind of do in Revived Thoughts, where you have the hindsight of a few hundred years to see the impact that these people have. 9 of his children became writers. And again, we already mentioned probably the most famous one would be Harriet Beecher Stowe, who wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, which was a tremendous influence on the anti-slave movement. And he has several children that have various impacts. Some of them have some controversies, but overall, I feel like it is a good contribution to American history. It's probably how I'd leave it.
Yeah, we'll leave it there. Despite all this, the place Lyman Beecher was most comfortable was calling out the sin of alcohol in his mind. It may be tempting to think a sermon on temperance doesn't have anything to do with you today. You may say, what do I got for this? But I think if you listen to this discussion, when I was going through this sermon and editing it, I was like, he has one of the best, I think, descriptions of the power of addiction that I have ever seen. And even though he's using it for the addiction of alcohol, I certainly think it could apply to many other addictions in modern society as well. And also the addiction of alcohol. I mean, there are plenty of people who are still alcoholics to this day. So it's not like it's a sin that has completely gone away. Although the United States, I don't think it's drinking 7 pure gallons of alcohol a year. It is certainly a problem for many people. Listen to this discussion of it and listen to him describe how important it is to live out our faith and not be controlled by any kind of substances.
Proverbs 23:29-35. Who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has strife? Who has complaining? Who has wounds without cause? Who has redness of eyes? those who tarry long over wine, those who go to try mixed wine. Do not look at wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup and goes down smoothly. In the end, it bites like a serpent and stings like an adder. Your eyes will see strange things and your heart utter perverse things. You will be like one who lies down in the midst of the sea, like one who lies on top of a mast. They struck me, you will say, but I was not hurt. They beat me, but I did not feel it. When shall I awake? I must have another drink. This is a glowing description of the sin of intemperance. None but the pencil of inspiration could have thrown upon the canvas so many vivid traits of this complex evil in so short a description. It exhibits its woes and sorrows, contentions and babblings, and wounds and redness of eyes, its smiling deceptions in the beginning, and serpent bite in the end. The helplessness of its victims, like one cast out upon the deep, the danger of destruction, like that of one who sleeps upon the top of a mast, the unveiling lamentations of the captive, and the giving up of hope and effort. They have struck me, and I was not sick. They have beaten me, and I did not feel it. When will I awake? I will seek it yet again. Again and again you are beaten. Again float upon the deep and sleep upon the mast. No sin has fewer apologies than intemperance. All are against drunkenness, and yet not one of the thousands who fall into it dreams of the danger when he enters the path that leads to it. The soldier approaching the deadly battle and seeing rank after rank of those who precede him swept away hesitates sometimes and recoils from death. But men see the effects of drunkenness upon others. They see them begin, advance, and end in confirmed intemperance, but are unappalled and rush carelessly into the same ruin. A part of this carelessness arises from the undefined nature of the crime in its early stages, and the ignorance of men concerning what we might call the experimental indications of its approach. Theft and falsehood are definite actions, but intemperance is a state of internal sensation, and the symptoms may exist long and multiply, but the person experiencing them may not be aware that they are in the signs of intemperance. It is not infrequent that men become completely addicted to their habits without suspicion of danger. Nothing, therefore, seems to be more important than a description of this broad way, crowded by so many travelers, that the temperate, when they come into sight of it, may know their danger and pass by it and turn a different way. What I will deliver on this subject has been on my mind for years, and I now have the opportunity to share on it. Intemperance is the sin of our land, and with our boundless prosperity, is coming in upon us like a flood. And if anything will defeat the hopes of the world which hang upon our experiment of civil liberty, it is that river of fire, which is rolling through the land, destroying the vital air and extending around an atmosphere of death. Let us first consider the nature and occasions of intemperance. The common idea is that nothing is drunkenness if it does not overwhelm the regular operations of his mind and bodily organs. However, much a man may consume of hard spirits if he can command his mind, his speech, and his bodily members, he is not considered drunk. And yet, drinking within these limits, he may be intemperate in respect to an inordinate desire for drink. The amount he is consuming, the amount he is spending, the effect of his health and temper and moral sensibilities, and even more, the ultimate and inevitable result of bodily and mental imbecility caused by constant drink. God has made the human body to be sustained by food and sleep, and the mind to be invigorated by effort, and the regular healthfulness of the moral system, and the cheering influence of a moral government. and whoever, to sustain the body, or invigorate the mind, or cheer the heart, applies habitually the medicine of ardent spirits, does violence to the laws of his nature, puts the whole system into disorder, and is intemperate long before the intellect falters or a muscle is unstrung. The effects of the ardent spirit on the brain and the health of the body is among the last effects of intemperance, and is actually the least destructive part of the sin. It is the moral ruin which it works in the soul that has its fall into the category of great wickedness. If all who are intemperate, drunk to insensibility, and on waking up could arise from the debauchery of with intellect and heart uninjured, it would strip the crime of its most appalling evils. But among the woes of which Scripture denounces against crime, one is, woe to them that are mighty to drink wine, and men of strength consume strong drinks. These are captains in bands of intemperance, and will drink two generations of youths into the grave before they go to lie down by their side. The Lord deliver us from strong-headed men who can move the tongue when all are mute around them, and keep the eye open when all around them sleep, and can walk from the scene of riot while their companions must be aided or wait until the morning. It is a matter of undoubted certainty that habitual tippling is worse than periodical drunkenness. The poor sailor who, once a month, drinks himself to death in all but simple breathing will outlive for years the man who drinks little and often and is not perhaps suspected of intemperance. The use of ardent spirits daily as ministering to cheerfulness or bodily vigor ought to be regarded as intemperance. No person probably ever did or ever will receive ardent spirits into his system once a day and fortify his constitution against its deleterious effects. Such a person drinking daily loses self-control and slowly but surely leads themselves into the state of inebriation. They may hold out a long time against this sapping and mining of the constitution, which daily tippling carries it. But eventually, this foe of life will bring to the assault enemies of its own formation, before whose power the feeble and the mighty will be alike unable to stand. Turning to ardent spirits as a means of invigorating the intellect, or of enjoying pleasurable sensations, is also intemperance. It is forcing nature to extort in a short time those results of mind and feeling which in her own unimpelled course would flow with less rashly but in a more careful and healthy current. The mind has its limits of intellectual application, and the heart its limits of feeling, and the nervous system of healthy joy. And whatever you gain through external forces, by way of drinking or force, is only so much at the cost of the intellectual and vital power cut off at the latter end of life. It is this occult intemperance of daily drinking which generates a host of bodily infirmities and diseases. Loss of appetite, nausea at the stomach, disordered bile, obstruction of the liver, jaundice, hoarseness of voice, coughs, consumptions, rheumatic pains, epilepsy, gout, colic, palsy, apoplexy, insanity, are the bodyguards which attend intemperance in the form of tippling, even if the terrible name of drunkenness may never be applied. Many people who are not considered drunkards create illnesses and shorten their days by what they denote as prudent use of ardent spirits. Let it therefore be engraven upon the heart of every man that the daily use of alcohol in any form or in any degree is intemperance. Its effects are certain and deeply harmful, though its results may be slow and alcohol may never be recognized as the real cause. It is a war upon the human constitution. It is carried out on the sidelines, but never fails to subtract more vital power than it gives.
like the leaking out of water, little by little, until the hole widens, till life itself is poured out of it. If all the illnesses which terminate in death could speak out from the grave, or tell their origin upon the coffin lid, we should witness the most appalling and unexpected reveals. Happy the man who so avoids the appearance of evil, and does not shorten his days by what he may call the prudent use of odd spirits. But now we come to a kind of experience that is generally assumed to show some degree of sinful drunkenness. I mean when one's reason is overthrown, and weakness and foolishness take control, leading to endless talking or stubborn silence, stirring up irritability, anger, or empty cheerfulness, or silly talk, unleashing swearing and cursing, or spilling out secret things, both one's own and others. And yet, to some, even all of this is not enough proof to accuse someone of drinking to justify church discipline. The tongue must stumble, and the feet must falter before, in the minds of some, a professing Christian can be found guilty of the sin of intemperance. To truly understand the full nature of drunkenness, however, we need not only a definition, but a thoughtful look at its physical effects on the human body. To those who see only the outward results, the victories of drunkenness over conscience, talent, learning, character, personal interest, and family love have seemed astonishing. But that wonder fades when we consider the fierce cravings it creates and the tormenting grip it lays on every fiber of the body and every faculty of the soul. The stomach is the chief organ that quickens the flow of blood, energizes the spirits, stirs the nerves with pleasure or pain, gives strength to the mind, and fills the heart with cheerful feeling. Here lies the silver cord of life, the golden bowl at the fountain, and the wheel at the well. When these parts perform their proper work, the physical, mental, and moral powers all move in harmony, filling the system with strength and joy. But when these central forces are weakened, the vigor of the mind and body fades away. Weariness, sadness, and gloom take place of health's high pulse, and the light of life turns into darkness. Experience has shown that any regular stimulation of the stomach, which raises its energy above the level that can be maintained by ordinary food and rest, will, once the effect wears off, leave weakness behind, a relaxation of the overworked organ that matches the degree of its unnatural excitement. The life-giving power of the stomach then falls just as far below the point of health and cheerfulness as it had been rashly raised above it. If this process is repeated often, it creates an artificial state of the stomach, one that depends on stimulation for cheerfulness and strength, a level entirely beyond what normal nourishment can sustain. It opens a void that nothing can fill except the very destructive force that made it. And when through long use the gap between natural strength and this artificial tone grows wide, and habit makes the false state feel like second nature, the man becomes a drunkard. And in 99 cases out of 100, he is beyond recovery. Whether or not his speech falters or his step stumbles, he will die of intemperance. Whatever name his sickness may take, it will be one of the many that lurk along the path of drunkenness, diseases which often heaven employs to carry out its judgment on the guilty. Of all the roads to hell that deceived mortal treads, none is so bleak and dreadful as that of the drunkard. The craving for artificial stimulation to make up for lost natural vigor burns like raging thirst and ravenous hunger. It is hunger, for the false excitement has become as necessary to strength and happiness as food once was. Nature, trained by habit to demand what she once did not need, now insists on gratification with a force as relentless as death, and for most men, just as irresistible.
denying that craving feels like a living death. The stomach, the head, the heart, the arteries, and the veins, every muscle and nerve, all suffer the exhaustion and restless misery that extinguishes life's brightness, covering heaven and earth with gloom. Every part of the sinking body calls out to the wretched man, urging him with a voice like a trumpet to dispel the darkness and revive his failing life by taking again the very cause of his torment. Yet the relief lasts only a moment, for the same indulgence brings the same misery back, deeper, darker, and more desperate each time. Every repetition deepens the shadow and makes the pain of self-denial more unbearable, until escape seems impossible and ruin complete. In time, the natural strength of the body wears out, and ever stronger stimulants and ever greater quantities are needed to stir what life remains. Until, at last, the whole dreadful process of slow self-destruction, with its suffering worse than purgatory, is complete. The silver cord is loosened. The golden bowl is broken. The wheel at the well stops turning. The dust returns to the earth as it was, and the soul returns to God who gave it. Yet, even these bodily agonies are nothing compared to the moral torment that tears the soul. It is an immortal being who sins and suffers, and as his earthly body decays, he moves closer to the judgment seat, staring ahead into a miserable eternity. He feels his slavery to sin, rattling his chains and crying for help in spiritual anguish. Conscience thunders, remorse pierces, and as abyss opens before him, he recoils and trembles, weeps and prays, resolves to change, and promises reform. And yet he seeks it again. Once more he resolves and weeps and prays, and seeks it yet again. Wretched man! He has placed himself in the grip of a giant who never pities and never loosens his iron hold. He may struggle, but he is bound. He may cry for release, but none comes, and the words "lost, lost" could be written over the doorposts of his house. Meanwhile, the spasm of his dying mortal nature fade, and the dreadful numbness, foretelling spiritual death, takes over. His will weakens, his mental energy collapses, and his once bold spirit sinks into nervous agitation and despair. His love for others loses its warmth and tenderness. Conscience loses its voice. The heart loses its sensitivity. All that was once good and beautiful retreats and leaves him abandoned to the appetites of a ruined creature. In this pitiful state, his reputation dies. His work falters. Confusion takes over, and temptations to drink grow stronger as ability to resist grows weaker. The whirlpool now roars. The struggling victim fights the fiery flood, and weaker strokes, pleading for help until despair bursts upon his soul, and with one final cry that seems to pierce the heaven, he ceases to struggle and is gone. A sin so terrible should be recognized and destroyed at the very beginning, strangled in its cradle. But usually, by the time the habit is fixed and hope of recovery gone, the sufferer has not even suspected his danger. It is therefore of the greatest importance that the many causes and occasions of intemperance be plainly described, so that those who not yet beyond help may see the peril and escape, and those still free may be warned away from these paths of temptation and ruin. For the good of the young especially, I will attempt to chart the road of destruction and to set up a warning monument on every place where a traveler has been trapped and destroyed. The first cause of drunkenness I will mention is the regular use of strong drink in the home. Used to stir up the appetite, ease fatigue, or create a cheerful mood. In these repeated indulgences, children are often allowed to take part, and their tender stomachs are quickly corrupted and shaped towards habits of intemperance. No household that has been accustomed to the daily use of strong drink has ever failed, sooner or later, to reap the sorrowful harvest of this terrible disease. Such a source of temptation and harm should never be permitted in a home, except perhaps as medicine, and even then it would be safe kept by the pharmacist, to be sent for only when prescribed. Serving strong drink as an act of hospitality is also a common cause of drunkenness. In that case, the temptation becomes a constant resident of the home. The bottles and glasses are always there, and occasions to use them come often, and even when no guest is present, the sight of the liquor, a feeling of weariness, a dull spirit may suggest a prudent use, until that prudent use, repeated often enough, becomes habitual use, and habitual use becomes incurable intemperance. In this way, countless fathers, mothers, sons, and daughters have been ruined forever. Among the guests who share this so-called family hospitality may too become ensnared, especially those whose professions lead them to visit many homes in a single day. And so what is meant as a friendly courtesy often becomes a moral snare. Instead of being considered an act of kindness to offer our friends a drink, it should be seen as an act of unkindness to place both them and ourselves in the midst of such dangerous temptation. Public gatherings and festivals are often major occasions of excess that leads directly to drunkenness. The temptations are proudly displayed and multiplied, and great crowds go out already determined to give in. Surrounded by excitement and the example of others, they easily fulfill their intentions. But once a person forms the habit of drinking, even moderately, as it is called, on every public holiday or social event, the desire soon grows to drink at other times as well, until the natural appetite for food and rest is replaced by the artificial thirst created by strong drink. Evening gatherings for conversation, brightened by the cheering bowl, have proved fatal to thousands. Though all may seem calm, intelligent, and refined, the feast of reason and the flow of the soul, yet in the end it bites like a serpent and stings like a viper. Many miserable men have later cried out in agony, "Oh, that cursed place of social drinking! There my hands were bound, and my feet put in chains. I went in as a free man, and came out a slave. I went in temperate, and came out a drunkard." In the same category of dangerous temptations must be placed all drinking parties and social clubs, whether or not they include gambling and late hours. There is nothing that spirited young men fear less than the thrill of drinking in such settings, and nothing harder for them to resist than the accusation of cowardice if they refuse. Yet, there is no single form of temptation that has dragged more promising young men into total ruin. The connection between such beginnings and their fateful end is plain, and the defiance of heaven so bold that God, in righteous judgment, often withdraws his protection and leads the sinner in his own way. Weak health and depression of mind are also frequent causes of intemperance. The sinking of the body, the loss of strength, the heaviness of spirit are for a short time relieved by stimulants. But the very thing that brings this brief relief is used again and again until the habit of excessive drinking is formed and becomes irresistible. Medical prescriptions have no doubt increased under the number of drunkards. Strong drink, given in the form of bitters, are used as a base for other medicines, has opened the door for the destroyer, and while the patient was seeking health from the physician, he was unknowingly receiving weakness and death from the same hand. The distilling of strong drink never fails to produce, around every distillery, a generation of drunkards. The cheapness of the product and the ease with which families can store up large supplies from their own labor lead to frequent drinking and widespread intemperance. The selling of strong drink, whether in licensed taverns or unlicensed shops, is a tremendous evil. There, men with no steady work waste away their days for a few cups of rum. There, those who have finished their labor for the day gather to pass an hour, but none are content to simply look on. Everyone drinks, and none for long remain temperate. Even the children of the neighborhood are drawn in by invitation or curiosity. They gather for social drinking, eager to prove their courage and early manhood, and there the iron hand of the monster grips them at an age when they should still be within the watchful care of their mothers. The constant habit of serving out strong drink in all its different forms and mixtures leads naturally to frequent tasting. Tasting leads to drinking. Drinking leads to tippling, and tippling ends in drunkenness. Turning to strong drink for comfort in times of trouble often ends in a fixed habit of drunkenness. The loss of friends, the worries of business, or the ruin of one's property weighs heavy on the spirit. Instead of casting these cares upon the Lord, many turn to intoxicating cup for relief. But before their troubles have passed, the remedy itself becomes a misery more dreadful than the sorrow it sought to ease. Once their griefs were temporary, now they are multiplied and eternal. Using strong drink to sharpen the minds or revive the body during study or labor is a fatal mistake. Many mighty men have fallen this way, never to rise again. The quickened pulse may, for a time, stimulate the intellect and restore energy, but the borrowed strength is repaid with interest. It drains the soul of its natural vigor and leaves behind that fainted of heart and restlessness of spirit that forever cries, "Give, give," and never until the last breath can say, "It is enough." Using strong drink as an aid to labor is one of the most dangerous forms of intemperance, precisely because it is so common and so little suspected. It is defended as harmless, even claimed to be necessary, but no truth is more firmly proven by experience than this. Strong drink gives no nourishment, and in the end it harms. All it does is concentrate the body's strength for a moment, pushing it beyond limits of regular endurance. It is the borrowing strength from the future, with no plan for repayment, and with certain result of eventual bankruptcy. The early settlers of New England endured greater hardships, performed heavier labor, and carried through life more health and strength than most laboring men do today, and they did it without the use of strong drink. Let two men of equal age and constitution work side by side through the summer, one relying on strong drink for energy, the other abstaining from it. And by season's end, the sober man will stand strong and vigorous, while the drinker will be worn out and weak. Ships today that sail without the daily use of alcohol, factories that operate without it, and farms that banish it from the field all run better. There is no mere peace, more health, greater industry, and higher profits from both employer and employee. The workers are cheerful, energetic, friendly, and diligent. Their families are prosperous, well-fed, well-clothed, and educated. Instead of distress and quarrels, their homes are filled with affection and often strengthened by the grace of religion. But where strong drink is used daily as a supposed aid to labor, it soon becomes a master. The habit fixes itself so firmly that the stomach begins to signal the drinking hour as accurately as a clock. Soon it is taken not only at those hours, but at other times as well, destroying the natural balance of the body, creating weakness that demands new stimulation to relieve it. When the employer limits the amount allowed, the worker satisfies its the growing craving with morning and evening drams brought from his own wages. The appetite becomes unquenchable, and the habit of drunkenness spreads widely until nervous excitement destroys natural feeling and the home becomes a place of confusion and sorrow. Until the craving for drink consumes the very bread of the children and leaves them in ignorance and crime. Until conscience grows numb, honesty and diligence vanish, except when someone is watching, and waste, conflict, and misery reign over the workplace and the household alike. When we look across our land, what multitudes of families are now suffering from the ruins of strong drink? What thousands of husbands and fathers, once kind, intelligent, and industrious, are now sunk into poverty, disease, and shame? What wives sit desolate, their hearts broken, their hopes gone? What children grow up in ignorance and want, learning from their parents not virtue, but vice, not religion, but blasphemy? If the evils of drunkenness were confined only to those who drink, it would still be dreadful, but they are not. They overflow every boundary, pouring corruption and misery through the whole community. They fill our poorhouses, our prisons, and our graves. They destroy industry, break families, waste estates, pervert justice, and multiply crime. They harden the heart against God and man and send soul after soul unprepared into eternity. Can this dreadful tide not be stopped? Yes, it must be stopped. The causes are human, and so the cure must begin with human effort under God. The first step is to understand clearly that there is no safe use of strong drink, no moderate indulgence, no prudent or respectable drinking is harmless. The path from the first glass to the ruin of body and soul is one continuous descent. The only safety lies in total absence. Let every family banish it from the home. Let every employer remove it from the workplace. Let every community close its shops and taverns that sells it. Let doctors stop prescribing it, except when no substitute can be found. Let ministers speak plainly. Parents teach faithfully, and the young pledge themselves before God never to touch, taste, or handle this destroyer. If the nation would rise as one, if the conscience of the people would awaken, if churches and families and citizens would act together, the evil could be restrained, the drunkard reclaimed, the youth preserved, and our land would again be blessed. Then would the homes of our country be filled with peace and plenty. Our fields would yield their increase, our schools and churches would flourish, and righteousness, instead of ruin, would exalt the nation.
I really enjoyed this sermon. It's easy to look at the sermon and go, oh, this isn't a sermon, doesn't apply to me. He's being too harsh on alcohol. It's not all bad. But I do think it's a good question. Like, he makes the point that even just a little bit of it is a poison to you. Like, it can be a problem for you. I don't think that means it every single person, you know, I don't want to go anywhere. Scripture doesn't say about drinking alcohol or anything like that. But I just think it's a good challenge to me as I live my life. What are the things that are in my life that are poisoning me? Or what are the things in my life that I've accepted because everyone's doing it, but actually maybe they're not good? And if I was really living my life to glorify God in every single action I take, what would be the things that I need to take out of my own life? And when I put those things under the microscope, I think I find areas where I fall short, and I hope that this sermon from Beecher is able to do that for you. And again, also, I think I said this at the beginning, his description of what it's like to be enslaved to alcohol, in a sense of being enchained to our sins, I think is an extremely good description of what it's like. I think it applies to any kind of addiction, and just the way it slowly crushes the person who can't let go of it. They don't usually realize it's happened until it's too late, and then they feel crushed by it. It's a very sad reminder of our state in sin without Christ. And so I really do enjoy this sermon, even if you know, it's just a very different type of sermon.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of Revived Thoughts. Today's sermon was narrated by Patrick Studebaker from the Cave to the Cross podcast. We always love it when Patrick is able to read for us, and you should check him out on the Cave to the Cross podcast.
Yeah, Patrick is great. We can't thank Patrick too many times for how many times he's helped us out, and this was a unique sermon that I sent to him. I was like, hey, I need somebody who can handle kind of a sermon that's not everyone's cup of tea. And of course, Patrick had no problem. He's awesome. We really appreciate him at Revive Thoughts, and we're always grateful when he can read one for us. So thank you, Patrick, again for reading this one. And if you are looking for a good podcast on philosophy or just interesting ideas or looking through books, Cave to the Cross podcast by Patrick, and he does really well on YouTube. His views do pretty good over there. So you could, I don't know how many bear. the bear, how to cook a bear market's going over to him. But if you're interested, after you finish some Revive Thoughts episodes, my bear cookers, go ahead over to the Cave of the Cross. I think you guys will enjoy it a lot. All right, if you enjoyed this episode by Revive Thoughts, we ask that you share it, tell other people about it, let them know. They don't have to cook bears, but whatever they're up to, just let them know about Revive Thoughts. This is Troy and Joel, and this is Revive Thoughts.